This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with the sister of Troy Anthony Davis, who remains on death row.
Despite seven witnesses recanting their testimony, the Georgia Supreme Court refuses to reconsider the death row conviction.
We'll also hear an excerpt from the recent panel at Left Forum 2008 titled, The Arrival of the American Police State.
We'll hear a speech from Clark Kissinger.
We'll take a look at the deepening economic crisis in the United States and the world.
Once upon a time, law controlled excess capitalism. It doesn't any longer, and we're paying the price.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Update listeners on the death row case of Troy Anthony Davis. Since our last July report on the case, Davis had a 90-day stay of execution, and now on March 17th of this year, the Georgia Supreme Court decided 4-3 to deny a new trial for Troy Anthony Davis, despite significant concerns regarding his innocence. Troy Davis was initially sentenced to death in Georgia for the murder of a police officer. The case against him was built almost entirely of witnesses' testimony that were full of inconsistencies, even at the time of trial. Again, there's no physical evidence linking Troy Davis to the crime, and no murder weapon has ever been found. Troy Davis was convicted of murder solely on the basis of witness testimony, and seven of the nine non-police witnesses have since recanted or changed their testimony, several citing police coercion. Others have signed affidavits implicating one of the remaining two witnesses as the actual killer. We welcome back Martina Carrera, Troy's sister, who has been very active in fighting for justice in her brother's case. Martina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We saw the really terrible news in the paper and wanted you to come back on the show. What is the status of your brother Troy's case?
Well, last week the Georgia Supreme Court came back with a split decision, 4-3, where they ruled that to not give him an evidentiary hearing or tell the lower courts to give him a new trial based on, yet again, a bunch of technicalities. And the Chief Justice, Justice Sears, and three of the other senior justices actually wrote a very strong dissenting opinion saying that the court was too rigid in its decision and that if they had granted him an evidentiary hearing, it most likely would have led to, you know, possibly a new trial. And I think that has been the biggest fear of the prosecutor and the powers that be that want to keep this case under wraps in this state, because it would yet again show that there's no case against Troy.
One second, I'm not sure our listeners will remember our last broadcast.
Sure.
Troy is on death row, is that right?
Yeah, Troy Anthony Davis is on death row in Georgia. He has a case where he's accused and convicted of killing an off-duty police officer in Savannah. There were only nine eyewitnesses that were used to convict Troy. No weapon, no gunpowder residue, no DNA, no physical evidence at all. And seven of the nine witnesses later recanted, saying that they were under police pressure, there was prosecutorial misconduct that led them to saying that Troy was the person that actually perpetrated the crime.
You've been trying to get a new trial, and this latest setback, really, what you've described, is a 4-3 decision saying you can't reopen the case and these seven witnesses who now recant can't be used for any reason. Is that right?
What it's just saying is that the court is not is siding with the lower court, saying that the lower court didn't necessarily err in refusing to give him a new trial, saying that what they actually wrote was that the court was saying that they thought that recanted testimony did not have as much weight as trial testimony because the people are able to be cross-examined at trial and they're more likely to tell the truth at trial, which is, you know, totally absurd when you're being, you know, threatened and intimidated to lie on someone and then you have, you know, years to grow up and mature and feel that threat has gone away, that you'll feel obligated to tell the truth. And the situation is that these people came forward to tell the truth, even though in the state of Georgia, they face perjury by coming forward. And because it's a death penalty case, they could get life in prison for lying on this under oath. So the thing that they would come forward and said, yes, we did lie, you know, and we're willing to face that, speaks volumes to these people. But what the court failed to address was that Troy's case had the longest clemency hearing ever in the state of Georgia. It was more than 8.5 hours long, and it was cut short, and there was supposed to be a second hearing.
Wait a second. I want to go back. The Court of Appeals of Georgia wrote this decision, a 4-3 decision, saying that the lower courts didn't err in not reopening the case, I guess.
Right.
What's your next step now? He's facing death, I presume. Are there any legal steps that you can do?
Well, as a matter of fact, tomorrow, the lawyers and several of the legal scholars from around the country who've written amicus briefs are actually filing for reconsideration before the same body of elected judges in Atlanta to ask for reconsideration to at least give him an evidentiary hearing. If that is denied, which, you know, usually it's decided within, you know, less than a month's time whether to reconsider or not, then we could apply for cert back before the Supreme Court. And, of course, you know, those are like water in a bucket.
But the Supreme Court of the United States,
yes,
saying that they should have given him an evidentiary hearing. But, of course, this is a state court conviction. And as you said, it's like water in a bucket. It's very difficult.
Right. And then we will be back, if they do not accept cert, then we will back facing a prosecutor that's most likely to give an execution date within, you know, a couple of days of that denial, and then we will be facing clemency again before the Georgia Parole Board because the governor has no authority to pardon or give clemency in the state of Georgia.
How long has your brother been on death row for?
My brother's been on death row since 1991.
Oh, my gosh.
This case has every facet of what's wrong with the death penalty. It's a race-based case. It's a black-on-white crime. You have police misconduct. You have prosecutorial misconduct. And it's really, really absurd because you have no physical evidence and only eyewitness testimony. And they've never had a case in Georgia where they had to decide on 7 recantations out of 9 witnesses, and then additional 9 or 10 witnesses come forward and said the actual shooter, they know, they've seen it, this person has bragged to them. And even in the court rebuttal, they say, well, some people just want to brag about murders to get street credibility. And one person said, one witness said that was close to the crime, said all he could tell was that the person was left-handed and fired from the left hand. And the court said, well, we didn't submit any documentation saying that Troy was right-handed. And, I mean, it was just really absurd.
Martina, I understand that some of the witnesses who recanted have also signed affidavits implicating one of the remaining 2 witnesses who didn't recant as,
yes,
the actual killer. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that night there was an altercation between a young man, Sylvester Coles, and another young man, Larry Young, where Sylvester Coles was actually pistol-whipping Larry Young. And that's what started the altercation where the police come out. But Troy was actually up there trying to intervene and protect Larry Young. And Sylvester Coles was the person that had the gun. He, Troy and another 16-year-old left the scene because they were threatened with the gun themselves. And later the police officer came out and tried to start the altercation, and he was fired upon. Well, Sylvester Coles, under, you know, he testified, and in his documents, court documents, he ran away and threw away his .38 caliber weapon, said he heard shots. He didn't know who shot the police officer, but he was the only one to testify that he had a gun. No one else had a gun. And then he showed up at the police department probably several hours later, I think it was 6 to 10 hours later, with a lawyer and saying that, I know who shot the police officer.
Was the officer killed with the .38?
Yes.
There was no evidence linking Troy.
No. And Sylvester Coles threw away his gun and was never made to produce it. And all the police accepted from him was that he threw the gun away and he never pursued it. And then he testified that he didn't physically see Troy with a gun, but he saw the imprint of a nickel-plated 38 in Troy's pants under his shirt. Now, I don't know if anybody knows about weapons, but I spent a lot of time in the military, and you cannot describe the color of a gun in somebody's clothes.
Martina, something that I've been wondering about, did the effective death penalty and anti-terrorism act that Clinton signed in the 90s have anything to do with this case?
That has just about everything to do with this case. When the witnesses start coming forward in 1996, well, we had actually one recant at trial, but when the witnesses, the bulk of them start coming forward between 1996 and 2003, the problem came into when President Clinton signed into the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, he made the law retroactive 10 years. And what that law stated was that you only had a certain amount of time to bring forward new evidence to prove innocence. And I think it was less than 2 years. Well, when Troy was convicted, it was in 1989. When he was convicted in 1991. So when that law was in effect in 1996, and then it was made retroactive 10 years, did that mean when Troy's witnesses start coming forward, when we were able to get investigators to investigate his appeals, it was already too late to introduce the new evidence? So no court to date has ever heard the recanted testimony of these witnesses.
You know, our friend and the person that really inspired us and inspired this show was the great civil rights lawyer Bill Kunstler. And one of the last observations that he made, I remember, was commenting on this Effective Death Penalty Act. And he said that this act, because it's going to work in the way it's worked against your brother, where innocent people are not allowed a court hearing, shows the real decadence of this system. And I wanted to know your reflections on that.
Well, I have seen and listened and learned about this, and I am just appalled. I have gone to different countries and spoken about human rights and justice. To me, it's very hard to be raising a child in the society where I'm saying, do the right thing, do the right thing, do the right thing. And then when we can see inconsistencies where people are being sentenced innocently and that technicalities keep them in prison and the status quo are just okay with that, it's very appalling to me to be able to sit and go out to a university and teach young people about law, and I'm telling them about this law, and they're like, well, this couldn't possibly be real because this is the United States of America. You know, it's really
amazing. That's exactly why it's real.
That it is real, because we're one of the biggest human rights violators on the planet, and the fact that we have people who are expendable. I'm thoroughly disgusted by it, and I live in a county where, in this state, we've had 5 exonerations from death row, and 2 of those exonerations are from the exact county where Troy was tried and convicted. And the DNA exonerations are mounting, and all the district attorney will say, because we've had the same district attorney run unopposed for 25 years, is that, oh, they just got off on a technicality. And that shows volumes about what happens in this atmosphere to which I live, because the district attorney and nobody else would speak on Troy's case before because they thought Amnesty and all these other groups were doing such a wonderful job and even cited them in the oral arguments that, you know, all places, Amnesty International and Atlanta Journal, are against us and say we've lost this case in the media. But now all of a sudden, the district attorney, he didn't have the statement in Savannah News Press because most of our city is Catholic, but in the Atlanta paper, he made a statement that Troy's lawyers need to print up the opinion of the justices of the Georgia Supreme Court and send it to the Pope, because the Pope wrote a letter in defense of Troy saying, you need to spare his life, this is not right. And so he's saying, well, you need to print up the report and send it to the Pope.
Well, Martina, Troy is very lucky to have you as a spokesperson on his behalf. We'd like to know what to tell our listeners about getting involved in this case, writing letters. Is there a website? What can people do?
Well, first, if they want to learn more about the case and everything that's going on, they can actually go to www.troyanthonydavis.org, or they can just Google Troy Anthony Davis and the screen will light up. They can go to Amnesty International's website, which is www.aiusa.org, and there's a petition that they can download, they can sign online, they can ask other people to sign, and we're asking people to not only sign the petition, but write personal letters to the Atlanta Journal, where a lot of the lawmakers and things live, and express your concerns about this case, that, you know, this is very, very serious. This is not like we're arguing over a sentence of life or 20 years. We're arguing over somebody's life over a technicality. They can also write letters directly and send them into Amnesty International, and we will hand deliver them to the parole board, because it's amazing, because the parole board never thought they would get this case back.
Martina, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We're with you in your struggle, and we want you to stay in touch with us, and we wish you all the best. Thank you, Martina.
Thank you for having me. And write letters to Troy. His address is on the website.
We'll
do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Good luck. We go now to hear a speech at this year's Left Forum titled The Arrival of the American Police State. We're going to hear from Clark Kissinger, longtime activist, going all the way back to when he was a founder of SDS. Clark was the organizer of the first March on Washington against the Vietnam War in 1965, and he hasn't stopped since. He's recently been active in the Not in Our Name Project. He's one of the leaders of the Mumia Defense. He's been active in the fight to expose torture by the American government. Let's have a listen.
I think, as Michael mentioned, that this panel is kind of the longest-running show in the Socialist Scholars Conference and now the Left Forum. We had a version of this panel in April of 2002 with Michael and myself and Lynn and Michael Ratner and Lynn Wineglass. And we were all struck at that time by the fact that something dramatic had just happened and was happening in this country, that this was not just a little gotten a little worse, but actually that we were seeing a sea change, you might say, in the way that governance takes place in this society. Some people invoke the Reichstag fire analogy with regard to 9-1-1, and I remember mentioning that I thought that the period of transition that we were going through right then was somewhat analogous to the transition from the Roman Republic to the Roman Empire. That is, you were going to keep the formalities of the Roman Senate and having two consuls every year and stuff like that, but in reality, all power was going to be exercised by the emperor from here on out. And I think that was a very prescient observation, because I think we've actually seen that come to pass. We still have the elections, and we still have the talking in Congress and all of that, but basically power has become overwhelmingly concentrated in the executive branch. And what I wanted to try and go into is, like, well, why is that happening? What has actually, why now? Why now? And what is behind all of this? And one thing it's important to understand is that all this stuff did not spring from the beady little minds of George Bush and Dick Cheney and Dick Addington. There are actual material underpinnings for it, which is what I want to get into a little bit. It is the product of freedoms and necessities faced by a late imperialist state. And some of the things that actually caused that to move in this way at this time is what I want to look at. In other words, there's always a fundamental necessity for capitalists and a capitalist economy to continue to grow and expand. If it doesn't grow and expand, it gets wiped out by competing capitals. So that general phenomenon is always there. But it gets mediated by, in fact, big things that happen in the world. Wars, competing powers, so all kinds of different things insert themselves into that. And one of the biggest things that happen for the United States is that the whole period of capitalist expansion that was set in motion by the United States' victory in World War II, where the United States reorganized the capitalist world, broke down the sterling and franc blocks, created the dollars interchangeable with gold, whole Bretton Woods agreement that basically put the United States at the command of the international capitalist economy, the huge period of expansion ground to a halt sometime in the early 1970s, and one of the manifestations of it was the OPEC oil crisis. U.S. had to go off of the gold standard, so on. It was something of a major crisis that was followed by a period in the 1980s of a very, very intense competition for world domination with the Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union, rather unexpectedly to observers both on the left and the right, collapsed, it created a whole new situation globally for the United States that had both freedoms and new necessities. One of the freedoms that it gave them was the ability to go into the third world and to internationalize production, what we now today call globalization, was able to go out in an almost unfettered way on a whole global scale. But the other thing that happened is it unleashed and uncoupled Japan, China, and the European Union, China, of course, after the restoration of capitalism in 1976. But these powers that had previously been dependent on the United States for a nuclear umbrella and protection became competitors. And people around the Cheney group Defense Department during the first Bush administration actually wrote some position papers on what we needed to do. And basically they said, look, America's time has come. You know, Henry Luce said, you know, that the 20th century is going to be the American century. But what these guys said, no, the 21st century is going to be the American century. This is the chance for us to clean up on the whole world. But if we don't do it, we're going to be in a lot of trouble because China is a rising power. The Soviet Union Russia is going to actually reorganize itself. And the European Union is coming together as a competing economic power. We got to move now was their message. And there was a great deal of unhappiness with the Clinton administration for not moving as fast as they thought it should be done. Now, this is the same Bill Clinton, of course, who was bombing the crap out of Yugoslavia and, you know, everything else, but he wasn't making the kind of global power move that they wanted to do. And they saw in this new American century idea that the real necessity that they had to do was to seize and reorganize the Middle East. Why? Well, they need to seize and reorganize the Middle East, not for profits for the oil company. I mean, look, we don't have police in order to subsidize the blue cloth industry. You had to have control of the Middle East because that's where the greatest concentration of fossil fuel reserves were, and it basically gave you economic control over the economies of China, Russia, and the European Union. It was a huge geopolitical move to have control not only of the Persian Gulf, but also the Caspian Sea Basin. Remember, the U.S. moved into all of those Central Asian republics that got cut loose when the Soviet Union broke up. So you have this incredible power move that was made possible by two things. One, as we've mentioned, is their seizure of power through the 2000 elections. Remember, there is a legislation that decides what happens if the electors are contested for a given state. You know, there's a whole procedure for handling it. It just was totally ignored, and the Republicans instead took the issue to the Supreme Court, where they had a 5-4 majority and shanghaied the whole election. So it was done under the rubric of the legal procedures, but it basically was a seizure of power. And then when 9/11 came along, it provided the pretext to set it all in motion. So what they call today the war on terror is actually a war for empire. And always has been a war from empire from the very beginning. Otherwise, why did they go and attack Iraq that had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11, as they're all, in fact, forced to admit today? Now, in organizing this, they felt they had to do several things. One is their vision of the new Middle East was to clear out Islamic fundamentalism and organize free market economies in the process of nationalization of the oil that existed in a number of states like Iraq, open those up, you know, to overall their overall global control. In other words, they were to become modern secular neo-colonies. But exercising these new freedoms also created some new necessities for them. You may have noticed that the Iraq war didn't go exactly the way they had planned. And so now they're up against some real difficulties around this. And in fact, one of the things that they've not only had the opposition of rival imperialist powers, but in fact, millions of people in the Middle East have turned to Islamic fundamentalism as a vehicle for defending themselves against the U.S. This is a tragedy. This is a great global tragedy because it means that the war that we're dealing with now, in many ways, is more like World War I than the Vietnam War. You know, we're not dealing with people who want to transform the world for the better, you know, defending their countries against foreign imperialism. We're dealing against two different forms of outmoded political economy and outmoded ideologies, you know, that either would want to take us back to the 18th century or take us back to the 11th century, depending on which one you might favor. But it creates a situation that is very horrible. I think one of the best analyses of this is an essay called Bringing Forward Another Way that was authored by Bob Avakian. But the point of it was to point out to us that if this is this horrible dynamic of McWorld versus jihad, as some people have referred to it, if it's not turned around, we're going to find ourselves in a great deal of danger. Because as was alluded to by Michael, these people have already set in motion the idea of attacking Iran. For a lot of these people, Iran is the route out of Iraq. And It's amazing when you watch the debates going on between the presidential candidates. You know, the Republican candidate, McCain, he wants to stay in Iraq and fight for a million years. And the two Democratic candidates say, no, we ought to start phasing out of Iraq. Where we got to really fight is Afghanistan and Pakistan. In other words, there's enormous unity within the ruling class that the United States must control the Middle East. Right? They'll have tactical differences over where they want to put their main emphasis on at any given time, but this is the way that they're going to go. And these invasions that have taken place basically have created a situation of no turning back for them. In other words, they all reckon, this is why none of the Democratic candidates will promise to be out of Iraq by any particular time. They all realize that a precipitous withdrawal from this huge power play that they've made would represent an enormous strategic setback globally for U.S. imperialism, and none of them are going to do that on their watch. Do not hold your breath waiting for any of the presidential candidates to remove U.S. forces from the Middle East. What, in fact, we're going to see most likely is an escalation. So with that as background, how did this then reflect itself domestically? Well, the Bush regime reflected a very interesting alliance, new alliance that came to the fore between the grouping that was referred to as the neocons and the Christian fundamentalists. And the neocons, the thing I found that was interesting and common about both of these people is they both look to pre-Enlightenment sources for their ideology. They literally do. So on the one hand, and the other thing that they hold in common is the neocons and the Christian fundamentalists all believe that the United States is God's chosen nation. That the United States has a special mission to transform the whole world. They all literally believe in this. They have, you know, different variations on the theme, but that's the ideology that guides them. And at the same time, the Christian fundamentalists, or I would often call them Christian fascist forces, brought an organized and coherent social voting base behind this, because the neocons didn't have their own independent voting base. So they brought in this social base, and boom. Manufacturing's gone in the United States. The New Deal social compact, out the window. All this stuff is gone. And what it means is it's going to impose a lot of suffering on the American people here at home. We are in an imperialist wartime ethos that's being set down. Mobilize against the Islamic menace. Extend general anti-immigrant measures, heighten white supremacy, open promotion of religion and attacks on science, and a climate of trade your rights for your safety. Now, the Bush regime just went ahead and did this. And many people have said, well, dang, the Democrats didn't have any backbone. Well, actually, the Democrats, I think, had an amazing amount of backbone. They've been willing to go up against everything that their voting constituency wants and have done this in a rather fearless way. But the reason why they do that, and the reason why they are basically go along with the whole premise, is there's a general agreement on the goals. The U.S. imperialism must expand its global control and must control the fossil fuel reserves of the world. And the second thing is that nobody in any political party of the ruling class has come forward with a coherent alternative program to what Bush is doing. Really, you think about it, I mean, if somebody else has a coherent program of, well, no, here's how to save U.S. imperialism. You know, here's what we should be doing. We'd probably be hearing about it in these election debates, but we don't. So there's just these little tiny, you know, squabbling at the margins over how it actually should be done. And now, as a result, they have a common necessity to see this through, no matter what the popular opposition may be. And that's why you don't see any of these Democratic candidates campaigning on the U.S. out of the Middle East. You don't see them denouncing the illegal seizures of executive power because they hope to be exercising them soon. You don't see any calls for the end of torture now or the repudiation of nuclear threats against Iran. Obama says, no, we keep everything on the table. There's no call to disband the global detention camps or in the illegal wiretaps. I mean, my God, what happened on the illegal wiretaps? When they were discovered, the Democrats had a hissy fit and said, look, if you'd just come to us in the first place and ask for authorization, we'd have given it to you. Why did you have to go do it illegally? So this is the kind of strata, the situation that we get into. And so the Democrats basically did become politically paralyzed because they didn't have an alternative program. And unfortunately, a lot of the middle strata in this country who looked to the Democrats as their saviors became equally paralyzed in this situation. So we see a country today in which the rule of law is under massive assault, as is secular government and the separation of church and state. And this, in turn, has created two phenomena. One is It's been a source of enormous exposure of what this system is up to and what it's about. But at the same time, it's created enormous illusions about what we could do. And unfortunately, rather than looking at the material conditions that underlie all this and why it's happening, there's been too much of, oh, the pendulum theory, it swung too far to the right, and now things are going to swing back to the left, or democracy is self-correcting, or the worst one is, oh, just 8 more months. Well, just 8 more months until what? Because, Frank, I was up at a forum at Columbia University, and I asked Jonathan Hafitz, who was on this panel, about it, and I said, well, what do you think these guys are really going to do about these civil liberties things if they were to come to power? He says, well, basically, they're going to just sort of trim them off at the edges and make them a little nicer, and they're going to be permanently codified into law. In other words, if this stuff is not turned around before the Bush administration ends, it will become the new law of the land. In other words, yesterday's unthinkable nightmare becomes today's unfortunate necessity and becomes tomorrow's new normality. So there's not going to be any going back to some idealized bourgeois democracy at this point, which it should always be pointed out is the other side of the dictatorship of the capitalist class. You know, democracy is a way of organizing a class dictatorship and operating it. That's what it always is, and that's what it always will be. But now we're in a situation, frankly, and this is both the scary and exciting thing is, Michael was talking about how things could get very extreme in the next little while. Frankly, if things don't get a hell of a lot more extreme, we're not ever going to be able to change things in a progressive way. In other words, the horrors are only going to continue and get worse, but we have to figure out how we can wrench every amount of freedom and opportunity out of that in order to change things around. Right now, there's a bad polarization in society. The polarization in establishment politics is between mainstream imperialists on one side and the neocons and Christian fascists on the other. This is not a polarization that's very good for the people of the world. What we need is a different type of polarization. We need to be fighting to repolarize society where all the defenders of imperialism are on the defensive, and those who want a whole new world are the ones that have the initiative. And critical to that is fighting against every attack on the rights of the people and bringing into life millions of people who will no longer accept the crimes of this system in return for the promise of relative comfort and safety based on the spoils and the parasitism of imperialism. We have to fight to free all political prisoners, and we have to open up the space for not only for resistance, but to remain tense for revolutionary openings, because another world is possible, and we have to be in challenging and inspiring people to go there. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As all of us are aware, the American economy is in the tank and has been for some months and looks like it's going further. How did it get there and where is it going? Those are the questions we're going to discuss with Max Fraud Wolf, who's an instructor at the graduate program in International Affairs at the New School University here in New York City. Max is a freelance researcher, strategist, and a writer in the areas of international finance and macroeconomics. His work can be seen at the Huffington Post, the Asia Times, Prudent Bear, and many other outlets. Max, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've seen in the last period, and particularly in the last couple of weeks, utter economic disaster approaching. We've already had 500,000 people lose their homes. They're officially talking now about a recession. You've had Bush come in and take out Bear Stearns. This venerated old Wall Street banking company no longer exists. What's going on? Is this some kind of a crisis that the policies of neoliberalism have finally brought to bear on us? What's your take on things, Max?
There's certainly no way to begin to discuss this crisis that doesn't absolutely have to include a discussion of the neoliberal paradigm and deregulation, particularly in financial markets, because that's where this latest round of trouble emerged. But actually, this trouble has been building as a structural portion of the economy for the better part of 30 years, aggravated and made worse, made bigger, made more international by the deregulation of financial markets and by the sheer amount of speculative leverage or debt or borrowing in those markets.
As our listeners know, we're a legal program, and you use the word deregulation. What does that mean to a person like me sitting out there who doesn't really understand what's regulated, what's deregulated, what laws were taken away in deregulation?
Sure, that's the $64,000 question, and I think it's going to be the jurisprudential question and the legislative question as the dust begins to settle from a fire that's still raging, so we don't know how much it'll burn of the economic infrastructure here. But basically, starting in the 80s, at a very aggravated pace, very rapid pace, we began to remove the shackles and limitations from what investment banks, broker-dealers, the people in the stock and bond markets, could do in terms of other banking, and to unshackle slowly the money center banks, the basic commercial and retail banking. And so we had a 20 to 25-year run in which all activities financial were removed from their sort of cages or boxes they were placed in as a reaction to the fallout of the Great Depression.
So in other words, after the Great Depression, they didn't just want a completely unregulated financial market. They started to put banks in one kind of box, investment banks in another, and put restrictions on them. And you're saying in the last 25 years, they've taken off those restrictions.
Yeah, more and more of what only certain kind of banks could do in their own market, and they can't. In other words, each was in their own box and they couldn't traverse into other boxes. More and more of these walls were lifted up and thrown away. And so more and more financial institutions, more and more kind of intermediaries are called between savers and lenders and such, got into financial markets. More and more financial market firms got into commercial lending and retail lending, and also insurance companies and mutual fund companies. And then we allowed and facilitated the extremely rapid development of the totally unregulated space in financial markets, which came to be so large that it actually exists outside the purview of any of our standard regulatory bodies, outside the SEC, the Securities.
What do you mean? I don't understand. That.
There's a lot of financial vehicles or activities that no longer have any reporting duty whatsoever or restriction on what they hold, how much borrowing they do, and in fact, how they operate.
That's like a hedge fund would be like.
A hedge fund is totally outside the regulated space. I mean, there are some regulations on activities, but there's no regulatory body that oversees hedge funds. And because of a large lawsuit, sort of famous lawsuit about 18 months ago, they don't even have to acknowledge their existence to any particular regulatory body. There's all kinds of specialty vehicles and what are called off-balance sheet vehicles and partnerships that likewise exist outside of the direct regulatory oversight of any particular federal, state, or local agency. They have regulations on their activities, but not on their institutional existence as an entity.
Now, as a dummy sitting here, what that sounds to me like, what if I look back on the few years, having this whole unregulated industry obviously a lot of money to go into all kinds of things, which maybe help boost our economy. But why all of a sudden is all that unregulated money causing us a problem?
Well, because when people have a lot of faith and when the tides are rising, all kinds of unregulated risky vehicles seem like a good risk. You trust the system. You trust that prices go up over time, whether that's the price of houses or the price of exotic financial vehicles or the prices of shares. And so long as you think that things are moving in your direction and you have a pretty deep-seated faith in the idea that these things are market-tested, so the efficiency of the market has signed off on them by virtue of their existence, and you think that rising tides lift all boats, you can buy any boat in the harbor. Right. And the boats that seem riskiest should rise the fastest. And if that keeps being true for year in and year out, the pessimists, the worrywarts, the chicken littles lose money and they either go under or they get aggressive. And so you have this sort of adverse selection process where the biggest risk takers get the biggest rewards and the most skeptical, worried folks get the smallest rewards and are either destroyed by having too low returns and losing clients or drink the Kool-Aid and end up with religion. And so long as enough people believe something is heading in one direction, then you have some momentum in that direction. All market, all speculative market prophecies are self-fulfilling.
Well, Max, let me ask you this. Over the last period, we've seen a real reduction in the strength of the trade unions. We've seen real wages frozen for some 30 years. We've seen welfare smashed under Clinton. All these ways that society used to function after the Great Depression, the neoliberals tried to take away. And now we're standing at the beginning of what seems to me to be an unrolling huge financial crisis. Can you try to tie those together for us?
Sure. I mean, part of what we did is in order to have the biggest, brassiest international boom, we removed the restrictions on our economy, on our market system, on our corporations, and on our banking system. I would make the analogy that's a little bit like you want to enjoy a beautiful afternoon, and it's been beautiful weather for weeks, and you live in a place where it's nice out a lot, and you decide to really make your house a winner, you cut the roof off. And it's amazing. It's almost as though you had a 50-foot ceiling or a million-foot ceiling. It's absolutely wonderful. Although you have a problem. If it rains sooner or later, you know, this is not going to go so well. So in other words, in order to have the biggest, most international, brassiest, brashest boom ever, we removed all the fetters, all the restrictions that cap the upside and cap the downside. All the things we had done to smooth the business cycle, which were mostly political, actually, compromises with the general public and various regulatory agencies in the government, we removed those to have the biggest, wildest upside
boom. Now, who's responsible for that? Democrats, Republicans, everybody?
I mean, it's hard to apportion exactly. Surely the Republican Party has gotten a lot of the benefit of announcing itself as the party that champions this. So one would expect them to possibly reap the downside risk as well, now that this looks like less of a grand idea, although many Democrats have been associated with it as well. It's mostly the sort of free market, private enterprise, market fundamentalists who have most associated with this, the people who are pretty sure that anything done by a state is done badly or done wrong, and anything done by a market is done efficiently, profitably, and right.
So this is really free market to the excess, yeah. Much more than almost any country in the world, I guess.
Yeah, large structural recessions tend to be intellectual turning points in the economics profession and tend to show up in legislation. So if the 70s, the late 60s to early 70s global economic slowdown discredited in many minds the Keynesian sort of social welfare state model and created an opening to the neoliberal free marketeers to say the problem is the state, the solution is the marketplace, and the way to grease the track toward profit and happiness and returns and growth is to deregulate all these follies that we've made, these government interventions, these tax and redistribution programs, which are nothing but heavy weights on our real engine as a society, which is private for-profit enterprise.
Now, are any candidates addressing this issue now in saying, well, we have to re-regulate the market, we can't have just an open, you know, brutal free market? Anybody talking about this in any real way to you?
I mean, Denis Kucinich had obviously he's already left the race.
Right.
He does make some mention of these things and probably is deserving of some credit, and did actually even before the crisis, which I think you'd have to give someone more credit for. He's been doing that 2000, 2004.
Right.
So even before the, because it's kind of easy to tell something's wrong when your head's on fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a better social return to those people who kind of notice that you're oiling the top of your head with a lot of gasoline, right? That's who saves you if you listen to them. But of the big three in the presidential cycle, McCain, Obama, or Clinton, absolutely not. And in fact, Obama's done well in part by showing that he's even more free market than Clinton. And he's gotten some support. At least in Wall Street, he's much more popular than her. She's not popular.
I've noticed that also. And he has an advisor, actually, from the free market school at University of Chicago. Is that
right? Yeah, he has a really hardcore kind of Goolsbee, who's a smart, interesting economist who's done has done some interesting work, would be as much of a free market, right of center economist as you've ever seen in any Republican advisory panel either. I mean, he wouldn't just be on the fringe for the Democrat Party. He would be on the fringe for the Republican Party as well.
Max Frodwolf, an economist, he's here with us in the studio. Max, give us your impression of where we're at today and where things are likely to go.
Okay, well, I mean, where we're at is also interesting in New York City, because New York, I think a lot of people in New York have a less than accurate assumptions about the way the national economy is going, because the turn down here was late to arrive, because New York City real estate and New York City retail and New York City as an experience, an international experience, is busy being bought up on the cheap because of our devalued dollar by foreign nationals, and that creates an artificial boost to New York City. In addition to which, New York City has increasingly become an economy run on wealth, not income from labor. And wealth has done much better than income from labor for a long time.
When you say that, what you mean is we make our money off of investment banks and stocks and
absolutely
all that kind of stuff rather than labor, people who have these big stock funds here and everything like that.
And we're a city of trust fund kids and parental support. I mean, there's an awful lot of people in this city working for $40,000 a year and living in an apartment where the rent is $39,000 a year. And you don't have to be obsessed with mathematics and economics to figure out that some family or other wealth is supporting their lifestyle. So in the big picture, sure, we're a city that pushes paper wealth transactions, speculates, and provides all sorts of luxury services to the wealthy. And I think a lot of people living here are living off past accrued wealth of one kind or another. And quite honestly, they sort of have to be because the price structure in New York is such that even the average job in the five boroughs would not buy you even lower middle class living standards in Manhattan and increasingly in the more popular areas of Queens, Brooklyn, et cetera.
Where do you think we're at today, generally, not just New York, and then where do you think we're going?
I think we are in the early stages of a probably minimum 1.5 to 2 year recession, best case scenario, which will be deeper than we've seen at least since the 80s, and looks like it will structurally shift the position of the United States in the global economy. We're going to see fire sales. In other words, we're going to see foreign pools of wealth and foreign companies cherry picking desirable American assets on the cheap. And we're going to see some significant long-term stress to the economy here. I mean, we're going to see unemployment will definitely, I would forecast, will be above 5.5%. So it'll be up significantly from by the end of the year, would be my guess. You'll see a lot of mass layoffs. And then probably the bigger question is, how do we respond to it? Historically, the United States likes one of two roads, popular among developed countries, to get out of a recession, which is inflation your way out of it or war your way out of it. And part of the reason that the bind is difficult now is because we have two wars going and an inflation already. So using inflation or war to get out of it is tricky when you're presently
fighting.
When you
say using inflation, as my understanding as a layperson, you simply print more money and feed it into the economy as a way of giving people more money. That's inflation.
Yeah.
And war is just spending more money, also inflationary, because you're printing more money to fight the war.
Yeah, if you have a huge structural debt problem, and the United States does, and we net borrow $1.5 billion a day from the rest of the world, so we owe a lot of money. An easy way to pay it back on some level, if you don't lose control of the game, is to devalue the currency so the value of the dollars you need to pay back is lower and therefore more manageable. That would also help indebted homeowners, and it might help in a very indebted central government. People have a tendency to forget, but you know, the $8 trillion or so that the government's in debt here is an issue as well, the federal government. So you try to devalue the money, and you do that in a bunch of ways, one of which is overprinting money. And the idea there being, with a fixed quantity of goods and services to buy, if you pump more money into people's hands, you have more money chasing no more goods and services, and that extra money bids up the price of the goods and services in a kind of social version of what would happen at the Sotheby's auction house. If a lot of people with the means to purchase an object on auction show up, all things being equal, you know, ceteris paribus, so this is the Latin assumption that we like in economics, it should put an upward steady pressure on the price.
And but as you said, we're already in inflationary and we're already fighting two wars.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you could happen to get us out of this recession in the next couple of years?
Well, it tells you that there's more of a significant risk that you get stuck in a recession for a protracted period of time, a la Japan in the 1990s, or the Depression here, which did last about 12 years. I mean, so we have had longer recessions. But it means that our traditional methods of fighting recession have already been in use more or less to cover up and make less structurally difficult the last recession of 2001, and that the sort of popular easy options of stoking the money supply to create the inflation to bail yourself out, or distracting and unifying the public with a war and the extra spending that comes with a war, which is the only kind of government spending that the American right traditionally will vote for. Those are a little bit less of options because we're already spending $1 trillion on Afghanistan and Iraq, and we don't really have the money for it. And we already have an inflation rate much higher than the official numbers suggest, and high enough that it's already a structural problem. We only really see it in certain areas, but you see it in energy and fuel costs and food costs.
What laws, if you were to redo it, I mean, apart from some form of socialism, but in a capitalist society like ours, free market, what kind of laws would you want to see people advocating for to prevent this kind of recession happening in the future?
Well, I think that there's a bit of an issue. You don't want to make such a delay on the new and innovative financial products that they can't come around and serve the market needs. But I do think that having totally unregulated production of these products with no oversight was never a good idea, and that's been sort of borne out. So I think you need to have a registration. I think there needs to be a burden that regulators and purchasers of new and exotic products have to be given a basic understanding of what it is they're buying with a highly neutral outside auditor, and that has to be done on an ongoing basis so that this endless black box mystery meat sales machine that Wall Street set up cannot be allowed to occur. Not because there might not be a lot of great innovative products in there. There are. But because the chance for all kinds of suspicious activity and the chance for people buying a lot that they don't know what the hell they're buying is a problem. I mean, I think Wall Street really grew and got out of control for another reason, though, which is worth mentioning, which is the structural upswing in Wall Street has to do with deregulation and upward wealth redistribution. And so long as our economy is reducing regulations that hem in these positions and redistributing wealth to the people who like to play in the stock market, you're going to have these kind of bubbles. What became bizarre here, and what is the bigger law that I would do, is I don't think people should really be allowed to speculate on their homes. And turning private houses into debt vehicles and financial speculation vehicles was a really poor idea, based on a longstanding American delusion that homes are a good investment and are some kind of a speculative product. They're not. They're a good way to not rent. They might be convenient and wonderful in a lot of ways. And they're a nice safety valve to borrow against in a crisis and help.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way that I've understood this, I know it can be a complicated explanation, is they've essentially taken a house and turned it into a security or a piece of stock that people buy and sell in the market. And then when the time came and prices dropped or something, or they couldn't get out of those houses, that the whole market just went.
Yeah, 10% of the America, 10% of America's homeowners are underwater. In other words, they already owe more than their house is worth. And that's before house prices are done falling and before the recession has fully arrived in the employment numbers and other places. So this is not going to be pretty. And what was securitized or turned into a security asset was actually their mortgage.
Right.
And the mismatch between borrowing and owning was not understood by the public either. So I obviously think that the role of these products should have never come to this prominence or importance. That was a weird way of trying to speculate and borrow your way out of stagnant wages, missing or inadequate benefits, missing or inadequate pensions, and missing or inadequate medical care. And had we fixed those problems, even the same speculative bubble that we had, which, by the way, they had in Ireland and they had in Spain and they had in Australia, they had in other places, it wouldn't have had such a decimating impact.
Let me see if I understand. You're saying people borrowed more money on their houses so that they could pay for basic benefits that they couldn't, that the state wasn't providing. Is that
in a significant portion? People borrow for all kinds of things,
right,
but I mean, there was a lot of borrowing to make up for inadequate wages and benefits.
The classic problem of capitalism, as I understand it, is the crisis created by the fact that what workers produce and what workers buy are two different things. They're not paid enough to buy back what they produce, and that there's a tendency for overproduction, which leads to cycles and crisis. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a insufficient aggregate demand problem is constant, and it shows up in recessions.
So here's my question. It seems to me that this economy is limping along. First, workers haven't been given a real wage, really, for about 35 years, but more people are working longer hours, both men and women, or children in the household are working to keep up with things. You had the dot-com bubble for a while. You had people borrowing money on credit cards for a while. I mean, all these things were happening to kind of keep it limping along. And is there something that they can always do to pull the rabbit out of the hat and keep it limping along? Or isn't there coming a time when a crisis here could coincide with a crisis around the world and we'd really be in terrible trouble?
Sure.
And then the kind of laws that we've been talking about, these repressive laws that have come in since 9/11, might be used against us if we try some kind of big social struggles?
Absolutely. They absolutely will be used. They were a prophylactic measure. In other words, they were in there in case you needed them, because there hasn't been a whole lot of organized social misbehavior in this country in a long time. Segments of the U.S. economy have been galloping to global dominance, and large portions of the American middle class have been sinking deeper and deeper into a quagmire, which is in fact no more remarkable than if you drink 3 gallons of water, eventually having to take a leak. In other words, since the 1970s, we've systematically torn down the institutional underpinnings that created the American middle class. And now we're all shocked to learn that when you destroy all the basic institutional pillars that produced a middle class, an accident of history, the middle class starts going away too. But nobody wants to admit that. Nobody wants to face what that means economically here. And nobody wants to lose their middle class market. So an endless series of social alterations and imbalances arise, buying cheaper and cheaper stuff from lower and lower wage good countries, sending everyone in the house out to work, keeping everybody working until older age, starting them working at younger ages, learning how exciting it is to have a special secret online business selling the crap out of your garage on eBay, borrowing everything you can on every credit card you can get.
These are all ways of keeping a middle class, is what you're saying.
When there's no basic structural underpinning for a middle class. And the really dangerous, interesting thing about a long, serious recession, now a distinct possibility, is what do we do politically and economically, we America, confronted with the fact that our middle class has been dead man walking for 20 years, and it's getting harder and harder to sweep that under the rug.
What made it dead man walking, though? What was the – when you said institutional protections were gone – how would you say what made it dead man walking that required the Walmarts of the world to exist to keep the middle class floating?
Well, international competition, while in many ways a good thing, exposed American workers, right, to wage competition with other parts of the world where wages just tended to be lower, which was certainly a problem. And I'd say much bigger than that, which gets less attention than it should, is technological innovation. So you have 30 or 40 years of basically executive-led technological innovation designed to de-skill and remove the power of labor in the production process. The easy example of that would be what happened to the longshoremen with modern containerized shipping. So you have technology designed to reduce the labor cost and de-skill it and universalize it, which tips the balance between capital and labor when you're negotiating over wages. So the technology is a big portion. International deregulation and trade is a big portion of the story. Where we once had a tax structure that systematically distributed wealth from wealthier people to lower-income people, at best, we have a neutral tax structure now, and I would argue probably in many ways, we have a tax structure that actively redistributes wealth upward. Okay, and that doesn't do much for the middle class. The family wage is gone. And when you pull the social safety net, you flood the labor market with lots of desperate people. So each cut to the social safety net decimates all wage labor more or less because there are more people with less and fewer alternative options competing for each job. And that doesn't do much to keep wage levels up either.
Max, thank you very much for being on.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We want you back again. We're going to need some frequent updates, I think, on the economic situation, given what you've had to teach us.
If you want them, I write them once a week for the Huffington Post and increasingly for Seeking Alpha, although those are maybe a little tactical. But the Huffington Post is.
Thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you for having
me. Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We want to give a very warm New York welcome to our new affiliate, WETX 105.3 FM, the independent voice of Appalachia. WETX serves the Tri-Cities, Tennessee region, including East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, and Western North Carolina. It's great to have you all listening to us.